Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule. Just whenever I finish a book, I do the review, stick it up here on the podcast feed. Today I'm joined by someone very special, my girlfriend. It's Juliana. Say hi.
Hi.
And we're not going to be reviewing a book today. Why not?
It's the 250th episode.
Yes, we are up to SFBIP number 250. So we thought we'd do a special episode here. And not only that, what happened is that somebody actually sent me an email or a message saying, hey, you're coming up to episode 250. What are you going to talk about? Last time you talked about your top five lists. What was it? Number 150? I can't remember. Episode 100. I talked about other things. And it's like, yeah, okay, every 50 episodes. It turns out like it's almost once per year because we did episode 200 last summer, I think. We were sitting in your
was
parents'.
Was it last summer?
Yeah, you were sitting in your parents'. Girlfriend. You need to talk louder or move this anyway.
Okay.
We were talking about it then. What do we talk about? This top five lists. And so he says, hey, how about we make a thread on SFBRP listener discussion group on goodreads.com and see what people want us to talk about. And lots of people put down different things. And I was like, okay, we could talk about that. I don't really have a full episode to say about that. I'm not really sure I've got a whole episode to say about that. And after maybe about 15 different ideas that people wrote down, I thought, well, what I'll do is I'll just go through all of them. So this episode is called Episode 250. And the title is episode 250 episode 250 topic ideas by SFBRP listeners. Know what we're gonna say? Yeah, listener suggestions of episode 250 discussion idea topics.
When you actually came up with that title before, it sounded way better.
Yeah, but I forgot what it was. It was when I was thinking about it, I came up with a really short way of saying it. Episode 250.
Listener's idea.
But it's sort of like SFBRP number 250, special episode number 250, episode ideas as suggested
by
listeners.
We should just talk about that, how we find the topic and make the topic here.
So
that should be good.
So what we're going to do is, actually I said this a few days ago, I said I could do all, the 1st of October, I could do all of these ideas, just go through the thread and answer every question and talk about every topic that's suggested. So guess what we're going to do?
Talk about every topic.
Yes.
Almost
every topic. I do have some notes here, though, so instead of just going through the thread and talking about stuff as it comes to me, I made some, I put some like ideas and some notes to myself because there's quite a lot to talk about here, but I think we can get through this. The thing is, on my first note is saying past episodes. Yes, we're up to 250 episodes, which is a lot of episodes, and the question is, have you listened to all of the episodes, Juliana? Go.
No.
Of course not, because there's loads of them. I look here in iTunes and I have all of the episodes here. 8.2 days, 253 tracks, because there's a few and a half episodes, 5.38 gigabytes. However, every month or so, I do get a new email, like another email from somebody saying, guess what? I've got through all of the episodes, and I'm like,
I'm up to date now.
Yeah, I'm up to date. Yeah. I'm up to date. I've got through all of the episodes, and that always really impresses me and surprises me that anybody does
that.
I
actually started to do that myself. I started listening with the very first episode, and then I continued, but I think I'm just maybe not a podcast person.
No? You don't listen to any other podcasts?
I have no podcasts. I never listen to podcasts. What I listen to sometimes, once I'm up, when finished Judas Unchained, I listen to audiobooks, but that's it. I don't listen to audiobooks, to podcasts.
Well, I'm a big podcast fan, but I understand if you're not someone who's into podcasts, I'd be very surprised if this is somebody's only podcast.
Your and very they first do and listen only, to it. Yeah.
So one person who is the SFBRP super fan,
Meudelhoff,
yes, he was the one who started this thread and posted lots of ideas.
Thank you for that.
Yes, thanks a lot. But it wasn't him. There have been quite a few other people. There are a few podcasts that I listened to all of them. However, not anymore. If I start listening to a new podcast and there's 250 episodes, I can't
go back.
No, there's just no way. There's no way. I mean, there's some things which I'll go back and I'll go, if this topic interests me and that topic interests me. It used to be that you could do it, but now there's lots of really long running podcasts. For example, you know, we listened to the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe podcast. I started listening to that probably when it was about a year old, and it's really easy to go back and listen to 50 episodes all the way through. Well, I say not really easy, but you can get through it.
Yes, and it's possible to listen to all of that, and then at some point catch up with with
but they've been going 9 years now. They're up to 500 episodes. Yeah, they do it weekly, and it's been going 9 years, so it's like 450 episodes or something. And in that, people, you know, there was one of the hosts was on there, and then he died of some disease, and somebody else has a new host, and then someone got married, and then one of the persons whose voice it was, that was the wife of somebody, and then they got split up, and now they got new together, and then they're having kids. And I'm like, I've been following these people for 8 years now. 8 years. And I guess for a lot of people, that's what it's like with me. I've been doing this since 2008. And I guess
a long time.
Yeah, I started off with you know, talking about this and with one kind of job. Actually, I guess I've been doing the same thing all the time with my job as being a juggler. So people know me doing
changing
that.
Changing girlfriends all the time.
So Paula, she never did podcasts with me, but you did. So that's good. So you're a good addition to this. But like I say, it's one of those weird things. So thanks a lot for everyone who has stuck with me 258 episodes. And if you're listening to this in the future, in order, there was episode number 63, which I said, hey, anyone who gets to episode number 63, I think it was 63, email me from the future to tell me that you've just got to episode 63 and email me.
I think some people did that, didn't they?
Still people email me. Cool. Not as often as people say, I've caught up with it all. I don't know why, because if you caught up with it all, it means you should have listened to 63. So anyway, so there's some past episodes now. So thanks a lot for listening. And I made a note here, future episodes. So I'm going to record this one. I finished the Hugular series, reading every Hugular award-winning, Hugo plus Nebula award-winning things, and I think we'll record that next week or the weekend.
You kind of finished it.
No, I didn't finish all of the books, but I finished all of the I finished everything I wanted to do. But I would need to do a wrap-up episode of that and talk about what that reading experience, what that experiment was like of not picking my own books, but letting voted awards and other awards pick my reading experience. And no spoilers, it was a failure. Or maybe it was a success. I don't know. We'll talk about that coming up. We're also going to do two more culture books and we'll wrap up the culture series. We'll do an end of culture series wrap-up like we started that last summer. That was just before episode 201? We talked about the culture, so that's taken us a year to get through the culture series.
But it's quite a lot of books. And it's not like you can just read one of the after the other, just like,
we could have done it, but like I say, I always knew it was just going to be part of our reading. It was just going to be part of it. Then we're thinking of doing we're going to do a series where we read through Minding Tomorrow, my series written by Luke Burridge's Minding Tomorrow science fiction book series. So we'll do that too.
Yeah.
And what was the other thing that we said we were going
to
do?
I read this about 2 years ago or 3 years ago now. At the very beginning, it was my very first book on Goodreads.
My book?
Minding Tomorrow was my very, very first book that I put on Goodreads anyway. So this would be just a reread. After reading lots of other science fiction, a reread, and then talking about...
Okay, we'll talk about this more later. Yeah. Also, I wanted to say Judas and Chained, Pandora's Star, Judas and Chained by Peter Hamilton. Don't talk about it too much, but what are your thoughts?
I know. Oh, well.
You're getting through it.
I'm getting through it. It's still about 7 hours to go. And you would think, now it goes to an end. No, it's not. I mean, it is storylines wrapping up, storylines coming together. And but you think, especially in Judas and Chain, there's so many story bits.
I don't want you to review it now. We've got much else to get through. I'm just saying that you're getting
big.
Through it. You're getting through
I'm getting through
we
it.
We will do a review of Judas and Chain. No, Pandora's Star and Judas and Chain. I'm not going to read it again,
cool.
Like I say. I'm going to just read the Wikipedia page about it.
We will turn it around then. I will talk about it and you will ask questions. You will interrupt and...
That's the thing. We've done that like with the Doomsday book and some of these... What was the other one? Paladin of Souls as well.
I didn't read it. You did read it, but it's a bit long. It's a bit.
Okay, then. So let's get on with this one. Let's hit the list of episode ideas that people had for episode 250. Once we've done our little state of the podcast section there, episode 250. So here we go. Meudelhoff, September the 11th. He wrote, I assume Luke will be doing a culture roundup episode regardless. So how about a sci-fi movie special similar to episode 200, but with lots of Goodreads friends, top five sci-fi movies. It's different, but very relevant to the podcast. He seems very passionate on the subject. And Meudelhoff left his top five. Number one, Donnie Darko. Number two, The Matrix. Number three, District 9. Number four, Terminator 2. Number five, Groundhog Day. And I was just thinking, I thought we covered this already in our top fives show of our top five books.
I don't remember. Did we have this kind of... Yeah, we probably had... a science fiction movie list. Yes. I'm pretty sure.
I think we talked about it then. And I just say, I don't, and this is what I wrote back to Arnold of Goodreads, I don't really have that much to say about science fiction movies. I want different things out of them compared to books, which is true. Like, and I said here as well, a book is usually a glimpse into the mind of one person, but a movie takes thousands of people. And I think that's the difference, or one of the main differences, but why I like novels is because everything there is from one person, or it's because you can have an editor who tightens it up a bit and does some of the language. But what you're doing is like...
So you have one writer, and you, as the reader, gets to get a view into the thinking and... brain of the author, and in the movie you have more people involved.
Well, it's not just more people, but it's like, yeah, it is. That's exactly it. Like, you can have like the auteur director, who's someone who has full control of everything. They want to control the music, they want to control the editing, they want to control everything. But like, when you're talking about science fiction movies, like, how many people does it take to make Star Wars or Independence Day or something like that?
Yeah, there's some very famous cases where there's a writer, and then there is the guy who gives the money, who's that called?
The producer.
The producer. And then there's the director, and all of them have different ideas about it. And then maybe sometimes the actors themselves have other ideas about the book as well.
Well, it's not that different ideas, but the way they act, there's only so close to the director's vision that the person can do. Of course, the director will say, don't do the line like this, do the line like that. No, don't mean it like this, mean it like that. But what about the people in the background?
It's a personal view of the people who are producing this movie, how that is supposed to be. Yeah. In the book, everyone reads something in all their heads is something different.
Yeah. And I think this comes back down to the movie that we watched. Was it last year when we talked about the book as well? There's in Sixth Sense. How can it go? My brain is just.
Even know what you're talking
about. It's the one where it's different, six different sections and told different times.
The Cloud Atlas.
Cloud Atlas, yes. By who is it? Something David. David somebody. David Mitchell. David Mitchell. And what was interesting about that is that you read the book and you're like, okay, every single thing here in this book is from him. And then we watch the movie and we're like, okay, we know what was from him because we read his book. And then we see how much is from the directors, how much is from the scriptwriters, how much is from the actors. You know, what did Tom Hanks bring into the role? What did these other people bring into those roles?
And there's a collaboration.
They can see that it wasn't just one person's vision. It was actually lots of people saying, I think this is important. I think that is important. I think this is important. And so that's why I feel it's difficult to talk about movies. And if I did, I would be saying, okay, let's talk about just the script of Empire Strikes Back. And now let's talk just about the editing of Memento. And now let's talk about that's not a science fiction movie, but I'm just saying, you know, like you could talk about the script of Memento, but then you talk about the editing of Memento, and they're two different things that I could talk about for an hour. I am very passionate about this subject, but science fiction movies to me aren't different than other movies. Does that make sense?
Yeah, of course. I mean, they're just movies, but I don't know. I think there should be a difference between famous book adaptations, like famously books that were made into movies, like Ender's Game, for example.
Yeah.
It's just very much, there was a book, and that book was successful before there was a movie, and then they decided to make the movie. And then we should think about, I don't know, is there a book called Fifth Element?
No.
Is that a book about it? Okay.
Probably not.
Is that? I mean, of course,
there's
the Guardians of the Galaxy
is
that it has some origins in some comics, but there is not a comic or a book specifically with that. And
with that story, you
with
mean.
That story. So
maybe
I think
there is
we should make a difference between movie book science fiction book movie adaptations and science fiction movies that are just science fiction movies without a famous book origin.
Yeah, but that wasn't my point. I don't want to make that distinction. I'm just saying what you can get from a movie, you're never going to get one person's vision from a movie.
No, of course not.
You're always going to get, and that's what I'm saying, what I like about novels is that it is a complete thing by one person. Like it's a unit of entertainment.
It's a one-to-one relation.
And that's what I love about novels, and that's why I can talk about them. And I think I can encompass a novel in a one-hour review, or I can talk about everything that I want to talk about in a one-hour review, because it is like, here is what I see from one person writing this book to me, the reader.
Yeah.
And a movie is just filtered through so many other views, like so many other people's brains and stuff.
What about books that are written by two authors?
I think they're so rare that it's you got to just take them as a writing unit.
Do you read a lot of them?
Not really. I mean, there's a few. You know, there's those Larry Niven, the Niven Pornell books. There was that. There was the Scar, which was by
Dune.
No, Hunters of Dune, and those other ones. No. Kevin J. Anderson and Thingy Herbert.
So it's. Yeah.
Other Herbert.
But is it a famous science fiction series with two authors that is actually good?
I'm not sure if they're good, but well known is the Niven Pornell series, like, you know, the, what is it? The Moat in God's Eye. And there's a few other books that I've, that Lucifer's Hammer. And there's some of the famous books that they wrote as
that,
a team.
If you have more than one author, it is actually not. That.
Yeah, but they're just two old racist American white guys. You know, there's diversity. There is this one book which wasn't actually written as one, because I'm just reading a book by Tobias Espakel. I'm most of the way through it, and he wrote a book with Paolo Bagagalupi. And they kind of took alternating chapters, and they created a fantasy world together. And one of them wrote a story that he wanted to tell in that fantasy world, and the other one wrote a story. And they had the same rules of the fantasy world, and they were set in the same thing with the same politics and the same magic and the same landscape and the same, you know, the concepts there. And
oh,
they
that both might, that they might both be a good approach, because then you can actually have the same. The same place. And
yes, but you could definitely tell the two different authors' voice. Yeah. And they were two very different voices, but playing in the same world. So that thing happened. The shared world novel, shared world short story collections does happen quite a lot.
Is that maybe like in Star Trek?
Yeah, I mean, I guess you could, like, all the Star Trek novels, all the Star Wars novels, like, lots of authors working with the same characters.
The same world, the same...
Yeah, but the difference is that in Star Trek, you can't just kill off Kirk. Or if you do, it's got to be...
it's got to be very, very big.
Only TV writers and movie writers can kill off major characters. The book people can't. But that's why now when they're doing these new movies, and Disney has bought LucasArts, you know, has bought Star Wars, they just go, all the extended universe, let's stop it. No more. And now they're just going, okay, this is the first book... written, which is in the new canon. You know, it's just the movies were the canon, and then they say nothing except the movies and the TV shows are canon, that's it. And I think the Clone Wars is still canon, you know, so the stuff that came out there. But all of the extended universe, all of the other books that were written, all the comic books, no more. We're going to start with new movies, and you can't say, but the new movie doesn't match up with the Thrawn trilogy and this, and it doesn't match up with that. And they're just going, nope, we're not talking about that. Nothing of that exists. Just going back to the movies, and I think now the TV shows, there's a new Star Wars Rebels thing coming out. Which
When does that movie come out? Do you know?
Next year, 2015, next year. Yeah.
Ah, we
new,
should watch it.
New Star Wars. Yes, cool. Of course we'll watch it. Yay. Anyway, so let's just quickly get on here. What's that list? Oh, that's my list of movies that I've watched this year. Yeah,
Luke has about 100,000 lists in his computer.
I keep lists all the time. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16,
he's currently
17,
counting
18,
19, the movies 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, in order, 27, by the way.
29, 30, 31, 32, 33, 34, 35, 36, 37, 38, 39, 40, 41, 42. 42 movies that I've watched this year already. We are quite big movie watchers here in this house.
Luke Moore.
But we watch a lot of these movies together. Anyway, yeah, so I was just looking through there, like what movies, good science fiction movies have we seen this year? Like that came out this year.
Pacific Rim,
not great. what have we seen here? Frozen, not really science fiction. Ender's Game. Mm. Ender's Game, okay movie. Godzilla. It came out this year, didn't it?
Edge of Tomorrow.
We both really enjoyed that. But Guardians of the Galaxy, I think. Oh, RoboCop as well, which was terrible. The new one.
Oh, don't do that.
Guardians
of the Galaxy. I think of all the movies that the science fiction stuff that we watched. I mean,
this year.
Yeah.
I'd say Edge of Tomorrow and Guardians of the Galaxy.
The newer bits
are the most. Are the only two movies that we've seen this year that were made this year. Oh, yeah. Look, I messed up your sound. Are the only two movies that we watched this year which could stand up along others. But let me actually. That wasn't the list I was looking for. So here we go. So some action adventure movies and general movies. So what I want for movies is a movie which I enjoy so much I just say I could watch that again. If that came on TV when I'm in my stateroom when I'm working on a ship or something, it often comes up, these movies come on TV, it's like, if that came on TV, would I, without any reservations, just watch it through to the end each time? And that's my only thing that I want from movies is pure entertainment.
That's
it. I don't really want them to make me think too much.
Yeah.
I just want to be entertained. So I made this list here. Not really top five, but here's some good ones. Star Wars, Empire Strikes Back, maybe Return of the Jedi, but you know, that kind of thing.
My favorite is Return of the Jedi.
I know, but
sure.
You're wrong.
No, I'm not.
Fifth Element, which is one of your favorite movies.
Yay.
Independence Day, which I have watched twice last year or something like that.
Yeah.
It's not one of those things, but this was one of my first, well, not one of the first movies, but it was one of the movies that I had on VHS. I think it was one of the first movies that I bought on VHS when I was 15. I don't know when it came out, 16 or something, but I remember I bought it and I was like, yeah, that's it, and I would just put it on and watch it over and over. There was that and Toy Story, that was another movie that I bought, and a few others as well.
I don't remember watching that the first time, but I do remember enjoying it very, very much. I think I saw it in the cinema.
What, Independence Day?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's great. I love it.
I did watch it. I did watch
and
it
I love
in
the humor in it. And the humor is so important.
I did a podcast about that.
Oh, yeah.
I did a full podcast. I did watch that one in the cinema. Jurassic Park, Alien and Aliens, both of those for different reasons. 2001, A Space Odyssey. Probably not if it comes on, watch it all the way through every time because it is quite a big movie. But it is one of those movies that like every few years I'll come back to and go, okay, let's do this again and sit
down.
We watched that together. You didn't like it so much? Maybe it's
I don't know. I can't remember it, actually.
It's everyone's favorite. It's everyone's top pick.
I just remember the music.
More recently, Matrix isn't more recently, but Matrix is pretty good fun. But again, I don't watch Matrix. I really don't watch Matrix for the science fictional elements and that there's space adventures and stuff. It's more the cool fight scenes and the.
Oh, watching the Matrix the first time, it disturbed me for about a week or even longer.
It blew your mind, man.
Oh, holy shit! And it made me whole thing like, is that actually, am I here? Am I not just in a tank somewhere and I'm just thinking?
How old were you when The Matrix came out and you watched it for the first time?
Don't know.
Oh, okay.
When did it come out?
Like 1999. I remember it came out like a month before Star Wars Episode 1. Or it was around about the same time. And I was like, and I thought Star Wars would be the big movie that year for me. And I watched Star Wars in the theater, and I watched Matrix in the theater. And
1999.
Yeah, and I was like, Matrix is the more important movie. It doesn't matter, but I thought Episode 1 was going to be the big thing. It wasn't.
Episode 1.
Mm. So Wall-E.
I was then 14. Right?
14 when you watched it. But you probably didn't 15. See it in the cinema. Did you see it in the cinema?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Yeah.
Whoa, man. And also Wall-E. I think Wall-E is of the recent ones, it's the only animated one. I think Wall-E is one of those movies.
Nice.
Which, I mean, maybe not now, but when it was out, and like I say, when it was playing, when I was working on a cruise ship and it was just playing on the TV, I would just sit down and watch it. But also, I would sit down and watch it, and because like the first 40 minutes is no dialogue, I'd be sitting there watching it, and then it would be the Spanish version, because on these cruise ships they have different,
And then it's, I'm watching the Spanish version all the way there.
But then I wouldn't watch it all the way through, because then it was in Spanish, I'd be like, I could kind of do it, and then it would come on, it would be in French, and then another time it would be in German, because I think that was when Polo and I were working down in South America. And going around South America, there's loads of different nationalities.
Yeah,
there.
Of course.
Loads of Spanish people, Portuguese people.
But we watched it recently. We watched it together.
What, Wall-E?
Yeah.
Did we?
Yes, we did.
When?
Last year.
Don't remember that. Yes. Also, some fun action ones: Aliens, A Total Recall, District 9. District 9, I think, is not a great science fiction movie, but like Total Recall, it is one of the. You haven't seen Total Recall. We'd certainly got to watch that.
Still haven't watched that.
Anyway, it's one of those things where you go, okay, the science fictional stuff is good, but also it's fun action. You know, it's action which makes you go, yeah,
And it's also really to get a view of the aliens idea in this direction is so clever. Because it's not just, aliens, and
it's
how
not,
is the first contact
first
going to be?
It's not first contact, aliens invade, that's it.
Yeah, it's that actually aliens are trapped on Earth, and they come together and we put them into ghettos.
It's very clever. Also, like I said, this year, Guardians of the Galaxy, Edge of Tomorrow, I'd have to watch them maybe another three or four times, I've watched all these other movies many times over.
Edge of Tomorrow, for sure, because now that's a bit, Guardians of the Galaxy is quite recent to us.
Yeah, both of these are very recent.
Yeah, but Edge of Tomorrow is a bit further away now.
No, but we both watched them, this year, this summer.
Yeah, but still.
Those were our last two movie theater trips.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Nothing in between.
No, I mean, we were over in Edinburgh. In Edinburgh and we were in Ireland. Anyway, also some time travel stuff. Back to the Future, of course. Groundhog Day, 12 Monkeys. And there's this other one that keeps popping up called Primer. And I've not seen Primer, but everyone always says, Primer, one of the best.
Primer?
Yeah.
Never heard of that.
Never heard of it. It's a very small budget. It's like one person in a room who then keeps meeting himself because he keeps going in these time loops. And apparently it makes sense, but I've not seen it. I wonder if we'll see it. But also, on top of that, the movies that I actually really like, which aren't none of these movies are great movies, but I really like science fiction monster movies, but not big monsters like Godzilla and Cloverfield, although I really do like Cloverfield. I put this down. I think I like things like Predator and Tremors and Pitch Black and The Descent and The Thing and The Mist, where you got a small group of people. They're normally low budget because really you want a man in a suit. You want like eight actors and each of them dying one by one.
All of these movies are pretty much psychological gameplay on you.
Yes. That's what I like.
That's
and I really enjoy.
And I hate that.
I really enjoy eight people, like in Predator, eight people go into a forest and they get picked off one by one until there's one or two survivors and that's it. In The Thing, people are in Antarctica. And there's eight people in, well, actually more than eight people, but there's people in Antarctica. They get picked off one by one. In The Descent, there's people and they go down a cave and they get picked off one by one by a person. What else have I got here? Yeah, the thing, pitch black. People are on, there's eight people. Well, there's more than eight. But I'm just saying eight people is like the general like size. Mm. You need about 10, 12 people, I guess, for a good one. You need lots of people, like three people to die in the middle. Then you need about four people to die as you go along.
One person to survive.
No, and then maybe three people to make it to the end. And then of the three people who make it to the end, like it's a coin flip to know one of them is definitely going to survive. Probably.
Who's the bad person?
And who is going to be the who is actually going to be, you're going to work out who is going to be the protagonist. And I really like those kind of, and those are just some examples of that. And also something like, which is some really fun horror, like Event Horizon. That's my final pick. All of the movies that I mentioned here are some of my favorite science fiction. So let's move on. The next thing, it turns out we did have a lot to say, but not a full episode's worth. But that was a good 15 minutes talking about science fiction movies. I think Moidelhoff should be happy. He also said you could tell science fiction or Luke Burridge's jokes for about an hour. How would you kill a circus?
Really?
Go for the juggler.
Really?
No, we're not
going
to do that. We're not going to do that. Okay, here's one. Sean O'Hara said, I'd like to hear Luke talk about subgenres, dystopian, cyberpunk, post-apocalyptic, etc., and why some work better for him than others, space opera versus military science fiction. Also, Alex Hamill says, have we had an episode where Luke talks about what he thinks the definitions of science fiction and fantasy are? I don't remember. He touched on it, saying that Slaughterhouse-Five and The Life of Pi don't count. I'd be interested to hear his things on things like the Cryptonomicon, which I've not read, which is science fiction without any future tech, or A Song of Arbonne, which is fantasy with hardly any magic. It might fit nicely with the subgenres discussion as well. So what do you have anything to say about subgenres, or a question for me, a bit more specific question than that?
When I read this, I thought immediately we should talk about cyberpunk, because I really like the idea of cyberpunk. It's appealing to me, but I just think I'm not punk enough.
You're not punk enough.
I'm not punk enough, and it's just way too crazy and weird. I started reading William Gibson, The Neuromancer, and I just could not. I just couldn't deal. I just couldn't get it. I just don't know what's.
Mentioned this. We did an SFF audio podcast, which I just put in the feed just a few days ago, about a James Tripchy Jr. Novella or short story or story. Can't remember the length of it, about 50 pages long, and I remember saying in that, like, I like cyber, I don't like the punk, I don't like the disregard for the human, for English language, and the disregard for storytelling that goes on there. It's just like, and then this happened, and then this happened, oh, we can just do this and just do that. And I find that so often with cyberpunk that I end up feeling that the ideas here are amazing. But I don't know, maybe I just think cyberpunk has already run its course. We live too much in a cyber, and this is a quote that I said, there's this tweet, and I mentioned this in this podcast as well, that someone said, unless you're over 60, science fiction didn't offer you, didn't promise you flying cars and jetpacks. It offered you a cyberpunk dystopia. Here you go. In other words, we're there now. And that's it.
Do you think we live in a cyberpunk dystopia?
No, I don't. I really don't think that. But all of the technologies that made cyberpunk kind of relevant, all of the ideas that are there, are in the real world to a certain extent, that it's no longer science fiction. Or if it is, it just feels really dated science fiction. I'm not saying, oh, people have Google Glass. It's not the Google Glass. It's more corporations running things, which they've always run things. But, you know, it's the environmental issues, and it's about the, you know, weird.
Would you
weird
also
stuff.
Say that cyberpunk is always dystopian?
I think that is one of its failings, is that cyberpunk hitched its bandwagon to dystopia it's weird to say mainstream cyberpunk, but the cyberpunk that everybody holds up as the classics of cyberpunk becomes too dystopic. It's like we have to live in a world where corporations have taken over and there's environmental disasters and the government doesn't have any more and the police are all corrupt and everyone is connected to some kind of network and people have things embedded in their brains. It all kind of ties into that, and that is now, you know, Ridley Scott's Blade Runner became the template. Everyone writing in cyberpunk after that was like, oh, we have to have like a noirish story told when it's raining all the time and flames coming from tops of buildings.
It's always raining.
And the cyber stuff that I really like can be found in so much other science fiction. Like, say, not the Peter F. Hamilton stuff. There's loads of cyber stuff. People have stuff in their brains, people are downloading memories, and people are traveling with stuff like in their brains, and there's all that kind of stuff. And I really like the cyber, but the combination of them two together, cyber and punk. The punk stuff is like the dystopia stuff, and the cyber stuff is just a certain level of technology that goes on in these, which informs the cyberpunk, and the body modifications. But why do body modifications always have to be wearing pleather and spikes?
So makeup? Okay, so that was just what I wanted to ask. It is called punk because people wear this kind of clothes.
It's the anarchic aesthetic.
Is it actually the idea of anarchy and everyone does what they want?
It turns out anarchy doesn't make for me interesting storytelling.
No, because it has major issues. Like our society has major issues, anarchy would have major issues as well.
So anyway, I'm just saying cyberpunk, I it's one of those things that I can't say doesn't work for me, but like there's elements which kind of just grate on me a little bit.
Like the Rudy Rucker.
Rudy Rucker. I don't want to get into that. I did whole episodes on that kind of stuff. And we just released this one about this James Tripty Jr. story called The Clockwork Girl. No, Something Girl. The Wind Up? Not The Wind Up Girl. That's something else. Anyway, but like I say, in Wind Up Girl, that is really dystopia. And you could call it cyberpunk, but they call it like clockwork punk or clock punk or wind up. Anyway, it's
clock punk.
I don't know.
I've never heard of that.
Because it's the technology isn't based around cyber stuff. It's based around clockwork wind up things that people wind stuff up, and that's where you get your power for these springs, which don't make any sense technologically. But then Paolo Bagatalupi, who wrote the book, says, "Oh, it's just a gimme. It's like we have this thing. We have a spring which contains energy, and everyone winds it up, and then they drive trucks around with this wound up." Anyway, it's an interesting world, but it feels kind of cyberpunky, but it's like it sidesteps a lot of those issues and kind of snuck up to me.
But isn't that then steampunk?
Kind of steampunk. And I think this is what maybe the key to it is. I don't like science fiction which is based around a certain technology or which it seems to be. Oh no, I do like that. What I don't like is a genre which attaches itself to an aesthetic and technology. Like cyberpunk is attached to the dystopian aesthetic bound up with cyber technology. I mean, it's right there in the name. Steampunk is, again, bound up with a certain technology and a kind of aesthetic. Yes. You know? But space opera kind of is, but also space opera can encompass those technologies and those...
So you can have steampunk in space
as
an opera.
Like Alistair Reynolds' Terminal World. There's airships and harpoons, but it's all based on this really weird kind of hard science fiction, but not really hard science fiction, but kind of magic stuff, but not magic, and these different zones of thought, and there's angels, an angel falls from heaven at the start, but it's not really angel, it's like a science fiction angel, like body modification kind of thing, but high tech, but in these different zones you can't do it, and these ones are agrarian societies, and it's all this weird stuff. But you realize, I mean, that's not space opera, that's like planetary science fiction. But it's planetary science, planetary, like, you know, like sword and laser kind of, not sword and laser, what do they call it? The sword and sandals? No, not sword and sandals. I can't remember. It's the, you know, like the Barsoom series, like the John Carter of Mars, where you've got like, you've got people flying around and there's sword fights.
Leather and sand?
You know, the John Carter, the Princess of Mars. There's airships flying and they're jumping around, but then there's battles. There's like sword fighty battles and
fairy tale.
There's lots of
science fiction.
Planetary romance. That's what it's called. It's planetary romance.
Let's come to space opera versus military. Is it really a versus? Space opera be military science fiction and military science fiction be space opera?
Yes, it can both be there. And again, I think space opera works because it is such a... The concept or the genre of space opera works because it's so vague. You can just say, what is this? This is space opera. What does that mean? It means that there's spaceships and people travel between the stars and there's adventures between one place and the next. That's pretty much it.
Does it need to be more than one book, like a series of books? Or one book be a space opera?
One book can be space opera.
And why is it called opera? What does the word opera mean in there?
Well, it's like soap opera, space opera. It just means, I think with the if something is operatic, it just means it's kind of like, not so much melodramatic, but like it's going for a more of an epic scale. Like, do you understand?
Like, opera is compared to a chamber music thing.
Yes.
Opera is something very...
Yeah, you can have a pop song, you can have chamber music, you can have country music, and opera. You know what you're getting with opera. You're getting something...
Gigantic.
Not so much gigantic, big. Just like large scale. I think like you could have a space opera short story, but I think almost the definition of space opera is that things happen on more than one world and the story involves a trip between them.
Okay.
Does that make sense? Whereas planetary romance, everything happens on, or like a planetary adventure, planetary science fiction is everything, you're on a different planet and everything happens on that planet, which is why the movie Pitch Black, where everything happens on one planet, it gets dark and the monsters come out, that's not space opera, even though there's a spaceship in space at the beginning. And like, what's it called? Avatar, the movie, just going there. That's not space opera. That's like a planetary adventure because everything has happened on one thing, even though it starts off with the spaceship in space. Whereas Star Wars is definitely space opera. Because it's an adventure.
Wanted to ask you for some examples of space opera.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Military science fiction can be kind of space opera, but it's much more like, okay, it's about the military units in space. It's not about space pirates.
That Star Wars is... for sure also military science fiction.
No, it's because it's not,
it's, but it's made mainly about the Death Star and the army.
Let me
fighting.
Say the very, very specific thing about military science fiction is that it has to be told from the point of view of the military themselves. It has to be a soldier in the military has to be the protagonist, has to be the person who it's told from. Ender's Game, who is it? It's person who is
in
the army. Forever War, who is it? It's someone in the army.
What about Firefly?
Firefly, no, that's space opera.
That's space opera.
I mean, it's like Western influenced space opera, but it's very space opera. It's very not military science fiction. Really not.
Okay.
Military science fiction is you're on a ship, a spaceship, and you're going into battle on a spaceship, but you know, there's different things, and I think those are my definitions of those subgenres and why they work for me and not work for me. Is that space, like as a like military science fiction can be planetary and it can be space opera and it can be cyberpunk and it can be all of these other things, but it's kind of restricting itself by saying I'm going to talk about this from the military operative's point of view. It can be a private in the military or a cook in the military or something like that. But it's no, I'm just saying it could be anything.
It's a fun idea.
What we're doing, and I don't find the military mindset that interesting. There are some very good books in there which explore it from a different kind of way, Forever War, Ender's Game.
Yeah, like Ender's Game. It's about a guy who is in the military, and then.
But why is it interesting? It's because he's not just a normal soldier.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. He's not just an order receiver, and he's also asking about things and stuff.
Listen back to my review of, let me go to the episode list. If you're ever wondering if I've reviewed a book or not, go along to, there's a sfbip.com/episode-lists will get you there. John Stakely, Armor, held up as this amazing... sample of military science fiction. I talk more about military science fiction in that, which is episode number 243. So not long ago, I reviewed that. What else was I going to say about the definitions of science fiction and fantasy? I keep saying this. I don't care what other people's definitions are, and I don't really have definitions for myself. But something just being fake just something being fantastic isn't enough for it to be fantasy for me. Just something not being real isn't enough for it to be fantasy.
And something that is fiction is not specifically science fiction.
Yeah, it's got to be a bit more than that. But the thing is, if it's got science fiction elements, like I've said, someone has said here, Slaughterhouse-5, the fictional elements of the someone who's making up, who's gone through a bad experience and has got PTSD and is making up stuff in his head, the elements that he brings in there is science fictional elements, spaceships being abducted by spaceships and all that kind of stuff. So for me, I'm not going to call it science fiction, but I've got no problem reviewing it here on a science fiction book review podcast. Whereas something Life of Pi, a fantastic book, one of the best books that I've read over the last few years.
It's just fiction. Yeah.
It's not fantasy. There is no magic. There is no technology. It's somebody making up a fantasy for himself, but it's not fantasy.
Exactly.
It is a fantasy. It's not fantasy. If you want to define fantasy as non-real, like the laws of the universe are being broken in some way, is fantasy. Whereas his, in that book, in Life of Pi, the laws of the universe are not being broken some way. It's just somebody making up a story. And I know that's weird to say, but it's a story about somebody making up a story and deciding to believe it, that he was the tiger.
Yeah.
Or, you know, or he had a tiger. Well, that's the thing. In the movie, they make it very clear that, oh, and this is this person, this is this person. And who was the tiger? He was the tiger. Yeah, that's what got him through it. He had to become the thing. And at the end of that, and at the end of the movie, the tiger, and at the end of the book, the tiger just walks away, doesn't look back, disappears. As soon as he doesn't need the tiger anymore, the tiger disappears. And there is no tiger in Mexico because he is the tiger who reached
out. The tiger helped him in... It's like just something that helped somebody out living through a very, very bad experience.
It's the same as in The Life of Pi. And that's why there was this book, what was it called? It was one of the Hugo Award winners, which was called Among Others by Jo Walton. And it's about a kid who had a car accident, and maybe she had a twin, probably had a twin, and her twin died, and then she invents fairies. You know, to get through that situation. And there's lots of other stuff going on in that book. But it's one of those things that, because it's fairies and it won the Hugo Award, I didn't have a problem reviewing it, even though I didn't really find it science fiction or fantasy that much. But the imaginary images... I know it's a weird thing to say. I'll let anything be fantasy, but I have to have a cutoff of what I review on the Science Fiction Book Review podcast, because then every book which is even slightly horror or even anything slightly supernatural would be here. You know, I read a book by Stephen King. Actually, I never got around. I didn't review Joyland by Stephen King. There's some other horror books that I've read. I'm just not going to review them all because something is slightly psychologically drama-ish or a few horror elements in there. I know. It's just, I don't have anything to say about those things, really.
Just coming back to the subgenre, Sean, who counted up what some journalists he wanted to listen, but he said dystopia, post-apocalyptic, and what about utopia? Is utopia even possible, not becoming a dystopia at the same time? Is that possible to just have a utopian book?
I'd say that the Culture series is one of the great utopian works.
For me, it is.
Because, yeah, like everyone who gets into culture, it's like, oh, I just want to live in the culture. And of course, why wouldn't you? Because everything is sorted. But it is, the whole point of utopian is that it just doesn't exist. And the whole, and this is the thing that like Isaac Asimov does with his robots. And he creates these three laws of robotics. You'll never harm a human. You have to obey humans. Those laws are. You should not cause harm to a human. What's the second one? You have to obey the orders of a human.
Yeah, but you should not obey the orders.
And you have to not kill yourself.
Yes.
Unless it goes against the first two or whatever it is.
Something like that
kind of thing. All of his science fiction from then on, when it came to robots, was exploring how those rules didn't work and how they went wrong and what was the problems with those. And that's what the culture is. You know, all the culture books are. It's like, we have this perfect society, and it's like the only things you can actually write about that is where it goes wrong, like on the edges, the aberrations. And someone will say, oh, the culture is like a libertarian society. And like, no, there's no way to do this. Like, oh, they're not interventionalist. And it's like, no, they are interventionalist. But what we're reading about is the few times when it goes wrong. Normally, the intervention
Everything
the culture,
is very fun.
Everything's worked. They've got it down to a science. They have literally thousands and thousands and thousands of data points to come through of all the interventions and all the messing around in other cultures that they've done to make these other civilizations more like the culture. Mm. And it's like people don't get that the culture is a political ideal which encompasses all political ideals.
Yes.
So it's like a pure utopian, because even when people do it, it's like, well, what do you want? You want to own a planet? Well, I guess we could find you a planet.
Yeah, because normally, like in Huxley's
Brave New World,
when you think, it kind of has this utopia feeling, But then it turns out
it's a dystopia.
Yeah.
And that's, I think that's the thing about dystopia, that I think that's why there isn't any utopian fiction, maybe except for The Culture. I mean, there's probably a few others, is because it always starts off as one thing. Like, we were watching the Lego Movie last night, and it's like, everything is awesome, everything is awesome, and everything is awesome. And it starts off and you're like, wow, this is like weird 1984 kind of like start of the Matrix kind of shit. And it really is. And of course,
everyone
then,
is happy though.
Everyone is happy and everyone's going on, you know, it's all going on, and there's this perfect city and everyone's there and everyone's following instructions and everyone's got instructions for everything, and you have to watch television in the morning, you have to do your things, and it's like, I mean, there isn't a 2 minute hate, but there is those, it's like watching that, the beginning of the Lego Movie was like reading the opening sections of 1984.
Yeah.
Of course, in 1984, everyone knows they're in a utopia, and here, the guy is, Emmett, is so brainless in the Lego Movie that he doesn't know that he's actually living in a dystopia. He thinks he's living in a utopia. So, I don't know, and I've mentioned this before, I think my definition of a true dystopia is if it's a situation where you can't get out of, it's a dystopia.
Okay.
And a utopia can only exist if there isn't anything else outside of it
that you don't want to get out of it.
If there's a chance to leave a utopia, it means it's not utopia enough because there's people outside of it looking in.
Yeah, but
like,
when you live in a utopia,
rich people, everywhere is a utopia, but for poor people, everywhere is a dystopia.
Yeah. Exactly. For it is always the two sides. For some people, a dystopia can be a utopia. They feel fine. They don't question it. They just feel that's good.
This is what I really liked about the Alistair Reynolds book, The Prefect, is because there's these thousands and thousands of different places to live, and people go, oh yes, I'm going to go here and go and live in this dystopia. And what's the only right that you have? You have to have the right. Is it to leave and to vote, isn't it?
Yes, to vote.
It's a democratic collection of dystopias and utopias. Anyone can live in anywhere they want. And
that's cool, because then you can choose what you want.
Exactly.
And some people might want to live in a utopia because then they can get out of it, and then they can say, oh, now I feel good about it.
So in a way, that is, I guess that is another, and that's the total difference between that and, say, Revelation Space, the rest of the Revelation Space books, because they're all set after the Melding Plague, where everything is very dystopia, and that's set in the same world, but before the plague hits, the Melding Plague hits, and everything is utopian for most people, but even the people who want to live in there go, I want to get out of this. Do you understand? So it kind of fulfills.
Because get bored.
Yeah. Anyway, let's move on, because we've gone for 46 minutes and we've still got a few points to get through here. How about a first contact special? Discuss the ways that, this is Moidelhoff again, discuss the ways that different authors have tackled the subject and how the world react if it would happen tomorrow. First contact. We're not going to do that now because we're going to review Blindsight and we're going to talk a bit more about that.
That will be the time when we should talk about all the special first contact things like Pandora Star.
There's more stuff in there. We'll talk about more about that in future episodes. Rick from Austria, I think. He says, good grief, man. 250 episodes. Episode topic. How about science fiction in Project Gutenberg? Which is all the old stuff and public domain stuff. Personally, I don't really use that as a source for my reading suggestions.
I don't use that very often either.
But if there's something like H.G. Wells that I need, or Edgar Rice Burroughs or something like that, you just go, what am I going to look up? I'll just go there, because it's like for old stuff. But I don't ever think, oh, I really want to read a book. What shall I read? Well, I'll go there because it's free. I for me, reading is something that I don't mind spending money on. I have an Audible account. I don't mind buying ebooks, and there's loads of other stuff to get here. So, Moidelhoff again. Check it out. Picture the scene. Aliens land on the White House lawn. They require a global representative from each corner of society to teach them about our civilization. Luke is nominated the science fiction ambassador. What 10 novels do you present to best explain what science fiction fantasy literature is and why? It just so happens that I kind of answered this in episode 200. I made my top 10 of all time... top 10 of all time science fiction books. Actually, there's some others which I it says here, from science fiction classics in publication order, which I read before starting the science fiction books. So War of the Worlds, 1984, Day of the Triffids, Dune, Have Spacesuit Wheel Travel, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, Ender's Game, Player of Games, Fire Upon the Deep, and also Deepness in the Sky, because those two kind of goes together. And
these 10 you would or how many
one, two, three, four, five,
these
six,
you would
seven,
take
eight, nine.
To explain how humans think about aliens?
No, it's to explain science fiction to aliens. which doesn't really make sense, but I think that's good. We've got War of the Worlds starting off, which straight away, if we were going to explain science fiction to aliens, it's like, this was our fears. You represented our fears of
being invaded.
Being invaded, because at the time, invasion literature, it was like all of, I mean, there was one of the big genres back in like the late 1890s in England was being invaded by France or being invaded by Germany, and a lot of the fiction was about that, and of course, for good reason, I think, as we can see what happened a bit later on across Europe. 1984, best dystopia ever, one of the greatest science fiction. Day of the Triffids, more interesting stuff. I mean, these are some of my favourites, but I actually said here in my notes, which I would give as being representative of good science fiction. So just listen back to episode number 200 for that list and some other lists, lots of other lists as well, and the reasons. Now I'm trying to find my notes for this episode again. Here we go, 250. Paul Julian said, perhaps you could talk about particular science fiction stories that have shaped your thinking or even your own writing, or pick out select specific authors that have had the most impact on you. And I think this comes back to, there's a few of these episodes. Episode 100, this is very clearly about that, because that's about science fiction and personal philosophy, and I talk a lot about that. But to go into, because we were reviewing Have Spacesuit Will Travel. Did you were you on that episode with me? No, that was an SFF audio podcast, but I also included it here on the SFBRP feed. Did you read that one? No, it wasn't.
No, I don't know.
Tarzan. No, not Tarzan. There was another Edgar Rice Burroughs book that we read together, I think. Anyway, 220, no. Episode 223, Have Spacesuit Will Travel. That is one of those books, and just listen to that episode. I go into a lot about it there. I don't want to say Heinlein influenced me, because I make it quite clear that I don't like the idea of Heinlein influencing my thinking or my being, because he's just a pervy old man. Not that section. It's not trying to have sex with your own daughter or young girls. Not that kind of side of him as a writer, but a lot of his kind of like being ready for stuff. And in episode 100, I do talk about how I live my life as though I'm a time traveler who hasn't time traveled yet, but I'm a prospective time traveler, that I have to have everything ready already in my brain, everything that I'm going to need when I go back in time to any time period, that I need to be that prepared. And if I think about my life that way, I am prepared then to be ready in any situation that life drops on me. And that's happened time and time and time and time again. Good preparation, knowing stuff already. And I talk about that a lot in episode 100 and episode 223, Have Spacesuit Will Travel by Heinlein. But the idea of living my life as I'm a not yet time-traveling time traveler has, I'm not kidding, I literally think about my life that way, and it helps me a lot.
I haven't listened to that episode actually, so I literally no idea.
You've got no idea.
So much. Like, you think, like, when you're going back in time, you're, as a juggler, you could make your...
Juggling is going to be really, really handy, because I'm not going to know how to start a fire, but I could juggle for people and they're going to be really impressed and give me food. I'm not saying that's the reason I juggle.
So that's a good thing
as well. Singing is not special.
I'm a woman. The thing is, I'm a woman. I'm not prepared for any kind of kind of time trouble. Not, at least not backwards.
That is probably true. No, the potted history of this, it's quite complex. I took a whole hour to talk about it on episode 100. I'm just saying that, like, if I go back in time, the thing is, it's not that I have to go back in time and be a success, but what would help me if I went back in time to 1960 to become a successful, say, singer or songwriter? Just because I've already got the whole back catalogue of all the Beatles and all...
You know the chords to play the guitar?
No, it's more about, like, it doesn't matter how many good pop songs that I have in the future, like that I have stolen from the future. In Mining Tomorrow, it goes into this as well. It doesn't matter how many songs that you steal from
the
future.
You could come up with Yesterday.
Yes, I could be the person who writes Yesterday, but guess what? It wouldn't sell, because it wouldn't matter. I would have to be Paul McCartney in the Beatles for that song to ever be recorded and to become a big hit. Okay. So much is reliant on... He had to have all those skills there. The Beatles had to have the skills, the songwriting skills and everything else, that when they were discovered in the right time, they could do it. And that's always what it comes down to. What you take back to the past is useless. You don't know anything culturally, what I'm talking about, like taking culture back to the past, taking stuff back to the past. Because, like, every book that you ever read, or every big all these popular books like Dune, was rejected by like 40 different publishers. And in the end, a publisher which normally, I think it was Heine, who normally sold car repair manuals or something like that, said, oh, we'll publish this, published it, put it out into books, and it became one of the biggest selling science fiction novels.
It's like the same with Harry Potter.
It's the same with all of these things. It literally doesn't matter about the quality of your work. But the moment you're discovered, do you have something ready to go?
It's all about the circumstances, and you have to be in the right circumstances, meeting the right people.
But if you find yourself in that circumstance, what do you have? There's a reason why I wrote Groundhog Day the musical. Why did I write it? Because in the moment when I'm discovered by anyone and says, hey, what musical project do you want to work on? I was like, oh, well, you know, I could write a musical. And they'd be like, well, why would we get you to write a musical? And I was like, well, I've already written a musical. Listen to this. If this is the kind of stuff that you want, go. How many other people have novels written just on the off chance that someone says, hey, we've noticed you over there. You're going to be famous. What have you got? And I'd be like, oh, I've got all these novels. I've got these novels that I publish online. I've got these other novels which I've mostly finished and not published online. You know, that's the kind of thing that you need to have. You need to have all of these backup knowledge. You have to need all these backup arts, all these backup skills ready to go at a moment's notice. And science fiction and time travel really influenced my thinking on that. And that is the reason why I'm a success in everything that I'm a success at. Because I put in the work in advance. And then when the opportunity comes along, I have everything ready to go. And that's
that sounds very much like Lucas Awesome, Lucas Awesome.
No, it's not Lucas Awesome. Luke is prepared. Luke is prepared.
Okay.
Luke is prepared. Everything that I ever do that I succeed in, it's because.
But
well,
now you make me think, how well am I prepared? I mean, yeah, of course.
Okay,
if someone says to you,
and this is what I talk about, this is what happened to me. Hey, you want to work on a cruise ship. Do you have a show ready to go?
Not now.
Exactly, not now. When that call came through to me, I did, and that's now my job. When someone says, hey, we've got...
Yeah, but if anyone from university comes around and says, hey, can you fix this problem with your PC or with our technological stuff? I say, yes, I probably can.
I know, but...
And I can design a very nice concert poster for you as well.
Yes, I know.
Maybe.
That's
my other skills.
Yes.
I'm
not saying that you don't have the skills. You have to have the preparation. If somebody says to me, hey, we want you to do an hour-long theatre show. Here's like €100,000 to do a theatre show. What would I have? And I'd have theatre shows already written, like juggling circus shows, like The Room Show, all those different kind of things. That's all there in case someone says, hey, we want you to work. Anyway, I don't want to get into it more now because we've gone way too long. We're not even going to get to some of these episodes. We maybe have to do a special 250 episode part B. Also, there's some good stuff. Don't want to go back over old stuff again. Maybe I'll take all that out. Specific authors that have had the most impact on my writing. I think we'll talk about that when we get to the Minding Tomorrow episode
before. Minding Tomorrow one where we talk about influences.
Okay.
And
let's just do these last two things.
You won't do my idea.
What's your idea?
The idea of making a quiz.
Yeah,
nobody sent anything.
Mm. Okay, this is Jenny from the Reading Envy podcast. She said, I had a librarian idea, being a librarian. I can't help myself. In the Dewey Decimal System, 250 is local Christian church and Christian religious orders. So if you could read one of the sci-fi books with religious characters or undertones, something like The Sparrow by Mary Doria Russell, a personal favourite, or A Canticle for Leibowitz. She obviously doesn't realise that I have already read and reviewed Canticle for Leibowitz twice.
I actually wrote that down for her, and I know I've put down which episode it was.
Oh, did you as well? Oh, yes, I remember that. I did it twice. So Jenny is obviously not someone who's listened to every single episode of the SFBRP, which is no problem. And if you're wondering, hey, Luke should read this. Has he read it already? Like, say, go to sfbrp.com, look on the episode list. You can search you can list everything by book title and by author and by episode number and by star rating and by time and all these other factors as well. So that's pretty good. Although I did want to say something about this because I did recently start reviewing this Yiddish Policemen's Union, and I kind of brought it up a bit there. So if you want to hear a little bit about why it kind of annoys me reading about science fiction with like real religion in it, it always feels a bit weird. You know, like the Speaker for the Dead has got some Catholic stuff in there as well.
Yes.
But what I liked about that is that he created a new religion, a Mormon, writing about Catholicism. Yeah, you can't even say it now either. It's weird when you suddenly think of a word and you're like, that's not the way to say it, even before it comes out of your head. But then he created the Speaker for the Dead kind of, not religion, but like a humanist kind of ceremony, religion, priesthood kind of thing. And that's what I like more about science fiction, where someone actually creates doesn't just write about the religion as it is, but kind of creates a new religion or a new strand of religion or a new era of religion, rather than just going, and now I will talk about Catholics because I know about that, or now I'll talk about Orthodox Jews, or now I'll talk about Islam, or now I'll talk about Hinduism, you know, these the people who, like the authors who bring more into it than that. And what I kind of don't like about Canticle for Leibowitz was the stuff which is too kind of close to the bone in terms of religious thought, with the controlling religious thought about controlling people's brains and morality and activities and lifestyle and everything about it, like shutting people away in monasteries, not because they choose to, but just that's what it is, and kind of brainwashing them into doing that. And the Orthodox Jewish way of like controlling women and controlling lives, and again with Islam and these other things.
For some reasons, I want to think that science fiction or that the future shouldn't have so much of a religion color in it.
No, but I don't mind it. But like when it's a fake, when the author's put in the work and coming up with something new.
But of course, we always want something new because we don't want how it is now.
But that was one of my things that I thought was a bit weird about Speaker for the Dead, that in 3,000 years' time, people are still going to identify Catholic. As Catholic and Brazilian. And I'm like, wait a second. Of course, Catholicism has been around for 1,000 years in its, like, I wouldn't say modern form, but now it's almost indistinguishable from what it was a few hundred years ago.
Coming up, that is a really good thing that I can just put in that quote that I got from the book called Mr. Penumbra's...
Oh, no, let's do it in a second. Let's do it in a second. We're going to get to that in a second.
Oh, really? Okay.
I just wanted to say another thing about this. Local Christian church and Christian religious orders. I grew up in a very Christian family. And there's this great quote. And I don't want to go into too much about this. But this great quote that I heard about The Stand. Stephen King's The Stand. And what I really like about that is that there is religious stuff going on and there is spiritual stuff going on, but it's all crazy. It's like a post-apocalyptic world and God turns up and he's fighting the devil and he's using people to do it. It's like super biblical Old Testament stuff. It's not New Testament, like, love God, loves everyone. Yeah. It's like fucking fire and brimstone shit and the devil, you know, all this weird, great stuff like that. And there's this prophet woman, this old, like, 100-year-old black woman who goes, oh, I'm going to be here and I'm going to lead these people and stuff like that, and she gathers everyone around her and stuff. And there's a great quote where someone said, hey, you really got into the mind, the religious mind. I think her name is Mother Abigail or something, Abigail. And you really got into the mind of this religious mind. How did you do it? And Stephen King's reply was, oh, my brother-in-law sold Amway products. And Amway, you know about Amway.
No.
Amway, it's like this multi-level marketing scheme where, you know, you buy some stuff from a person up and then you distribute it to other people below you, and then they try and sell it to other people and distribute it. It's like a pyramid scheme where it's a big scam. It's a big scam.
Okay.
It's a well-known pyramid scheme.
I heard the name.
Multi-level marketing pyramid scheme. You know, it's literally like, oh, everyone give me $10 and then tell 10 people to all give you $10. And you're like, okay. And
it's
then
like a snowball thing.
Yeah, it's like snowballs running. But you've got to be in the first like four levels. Otherwise, literally every single person in the world has to be involved giving $10 around. Like, you can't be more than three rungs down on a multi-level marketing scheme or a pyramid scheme for you not to be making any money.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, literally, you run out of people in civilization or the world. No, I say in the world, but like in the situation that goes. And it's one of those weird things that there was a time in my life, or when I was a kid, when I was like 8 or 9 years old, my parents got into Amway and started like buying stuff in and doing this. Oh, they had all these different things, and it was just like really like shitty. I wouldn't say shitty, but like no,
what?
Like kitchen cleaning products, detergent, all this stuff which has no intrinsic value. It's really cheap to make. They would just package existing brands. Well, not existing brands, but like the same. All the brands were the same. But then the whole value was that, oh, this is really great and you've got to believe in it. And then you try and sell it to all your friends and your friends get in.
It's like Tupperware?
Yeah, like kind of. I don't know if Tupperware is really multi-level marketing, but you know, it's a similar kind of thing. The Tupperware parties. Actually, I don't know if Tupperware parties is the same kind of thing, but you become a representative and you sell to other people, and but you have to buy the product, and then you always end up buying more product because
you buy the product yourself, and then you're selling it to other people by mouth to mouth.
But also, the key thing is that you're selling it to other people, and then they're going to resell it. But you get profits for everyone below you on the ladder in the scheme, you get profit. You get some of their profits as you do them. But again, it's only the few levels at the top which make any profit.
At some point, it gets below $10.
Anyway, I thought that was really funny that listening to that quote, because I was like, the same kind of thing, which you've got to be a church leader or get people in and go into this kind of thing.
Yeah, you have to be the leader, not the follower.
Exactly. You've got to be a leader and you've got to be an Amway salesperson. And then I was like, yeah, of course you do. And then I was like, oh shit, my parents as Christians and bringing me up Christians, they got sucked into the same thing. I wouldn't say sucked into that. I don't want to say that that Christianity is like Amway, but it's the same, I wouldn't say lack of critical thinking, but that same kind of like, and I don't want to say basic ignorance, it's just it's the way of looking at life, that if you don't have that critical thinkingness, a cap on, if you don't hear something and go, wait a second, how does that work? Oh, wait a second, is that bullshit? You know, all these different kind of things that you can get sucked in. Of course, it doesn't count with a stand, because there literally is supernatural stuff going on. Yeah. God does turn up, you know.
But this is what when we talked about, we did a talk about the stranger in the strange land, didn't we?
Yeah.
Where he's just creating his own religion.
Yeah.
And
but it's based around his own personal charisma and things.
Yeah, but he's just creating his and he's making the religion. And this is what I did not like about this book at the end, how it became all about people just admiring him.
But let me say, the thing that I like about The Stand, and that, I mean, I didn't like the book itself, but the thing I can understand about Stranger in a Strange Land is that there is actually supernatural stuff going on. He literally, like, John Smith, no, what's his name? Mike?
Yeah, Michael Smith.
Michael Smith is a...
Yeah.
He literally can make people disappear. He can bend space and time.
He actually
like that.
can do that.
So I understand how people find that appealing and go to it. What I don't like about, even no matter that there is like one supernatural element with the Wandering Jew in Canticle for Leibowitz, is that it's just people being deceived by a church. It's not like The Stand where there's actually God is turning up and there are literally people having visions and there really is a battle between light and dark and good and evil going on, playing out in the world now that there's after in the apocalypse. And you know, when there is that kind of fantasy element, I actually really like the exploration of belief and the exploration of control and the exploration of the mindsets of religious people and religious belief. But when it's just like, we're in a real world, now let's talk about these people being deceived by Catholic people. And I'm like, it's always just a bit too close to the bone.
But that's not fiction.
No, it's not. That's why when I was reading this alternate history of the Yiddish Policeman's Union by Michael Chabon, I was just like, I don't want to read about like people being controlled by bits of string around the neighborhood. If it was like science fictional, it would be fun to read about. And if it was true, it would be fun to read about. I mean, not true. If like there was actually some supernatural stuff going on there. But because it was literally just describing what it's like riding, like being in Brooklyn in New York, and the kids whose penises are being bitten off by priests. And don't you know that? When a kid gets circumcised they have to suck the blood out of the end of the penis. So the old rabbis are putting babies' penises in their mouth and sucking them. Ooh. Yeah, that's the kind of thing that is all part of that. And I'm just like, I don't like reading about that, as though it's quirky and interesting, because all I see it is depressing and damaging.
Is that a
and
fact?
Abuse. Yeah. Anyway, there's all of the all the different things. Oh yeah, and so that's why in young Jewish boys in New York, there's quite a proliferation of herpes, because the men have
herpes on them. It's a virus.
And they just give herpes to 8-year old boys. Yeah. Oh, no, not 8-year old, 8-day old boys have got herpes and stuff, and that's just not right. I mean, anyway. Let's move on.
This is a totally other topic.
Also, critical thinking. We just watched this thing. We're really enjoying watching John Oliver's Last Week Tonight, the videos that he puts on. And it's really fun every time that comes up, Juliana's like, how can civil forfeiture be a thing? And I was like, yeah, I've been depressed about this for years. And you're like, I didn't
know that. And the thing is, I don't have enough contact to America that I know about all the bad things that are going on there. I suspect all that, and I'm not a fan. Really not so much.
And then there's this one
there's this thing coming up where I think, what, really? Why is not everyone screaming and making all the kinds of noises about this kind of shit that's going on there?
Anyway, today you watched a video about Ayn Rand.
Nobody was quite sure about the name.
Yeah, And it's like,
I've never heard about that person.
You've never heard about, yeah, anyway, I thought it was one of those things. But it's one of those critical thinking things. Like, I'm not saying that's a religion, but it is kind of that religious thinking. It's like, people get into it and they don't just go, hey, wait a second, is this bullshit? Now, I know there's some really, really annoying stuff which I get taken in by that I'll just believe. And then a few years later, I'll be like, oh, that turns out not true. And you're like, damn it, how did I get caught up with that? You know?
Yeah. But this is why I always, when I'm really into some topic, like we went to the ALS bucket challenge, I really wanted to know about the ALS association, and I wanted
to
know about.
You ended up reading the financial report.
I ended up reading all this stuff. It doesn't always mean that I understand everything to the topic, to the basic of the topic, but there's other bits like the TTIP and CETA thing that they want to do between the United States and Europe. And I always try to understand what is the thing, why are people talking about it, and so many people are immediately against something or immediately for something, and they don't look under the surface to find out maybe there's some good stuff in it, maybe there's some bad stuff in it.
But this is what happens to me every single time. So I'm gonna post something on Facebook and I'll click on the link and I'll just be like, I can't just take
one
website's meaning for it. And if I read another three websites that and there's a conflicting story, then I'll just go like, well, that topic is too conflict. It's too complex.
And I would have to really study something to then actually have an opinion.
But this is a cool thing, actually. You might not notice this. When you click on a link on Facebook, it'll often say, and here's three other suggested links. Often, one of those three suggested links will be the debunking of the thing that you just read.
Yeah.
Like, there was this one thing that I saw. It's official. President Obama is better than President Reagan in terms of economic issues. And I was like, clicked on it. I was like, well, that sounds a bit fishy. Mm. And then there was another link and it was like, more on these numbers. And I clicked on them. And it was like, yeah, it's a little bit more complicated than that. And then it turns out the world is totally different than it was in the 1970s. And there's just no way to compare them. And of course, and this is the thing that I talk about in my review of Atlas Shrugged. It's always a little bit more complicated than you might think. And that's always what it comes down to.
Always. It's never just, this is good.
Anyway,
I thought I'd bring
that up as just as another. I know it's weird to say that goes into episode 2. What was it? 250. What's it come up with? A local Christian church and Christian religious orders. That is not Ayn Rand. She was totally different. But it is
kind of religious behavior.
There's these two last things here which I thought would be interesting. Klaus Varius said, "I read the book All Yesterdays lately, and it's a nonfiction book, but it's about fiction. It's basically about how to draw dinosaurs and how the drawing of dinosaurs is changing the way we think of them." And that's very true. Like, when you see the first pictures of iguanas, like in the Berlin Zoo, there's the massive life-size iguanodon.
Yes.
And it doesn't look anything like we see iguanodons. And now we know, they probably have feathers. So, it's always changing, all these dinosaurs. And it says, instead of talking about science fiction, science made into fiction, how about talking about fiction that is made into science? Hold that thought, because I'm going to come back to that. This is the last topic. I'm going to combine these two. Sean O'Hara said, another one from Sean, how about this? Luke's 8-year-old self gets sucked through time to 2014. What does he think? Is it a horrible dystopia or wonderful place to live? What aspect of the world does he find the most science fictional? What disappoints him because it hasn't changed? When he finally goes back in time, what aspects of the future does he try to change? I quite like that. Meudelhoff says, an 8-year-old would probably be dismayed at the size of modern chocolate bars. But if I was 8-year-old, everything looks small. Like, everything around me is always small. And I thought I'd just talk a bit about this, because we were just talking about, we went out for pizza before and we were talking a little bit about these topics. And I'm not going to restrict myself to 8 years old. What I'm going to do is restrict myself between the years of 8 and 10. Because between the years of 8 and 10, there's different, I think I've mentioned this before on the podcast, that there's different world events which you can kind of tell what generation somebody is by what age they were, not what age they were, like how aware
well,
of the
remember.
Word, like how aware of the world they were when something happens. For me, one of the first big world events that happened, like where people go, where were you when this, or what did you think of when this happened? The first of all was the Challenger disaster, where the space shuttle blew up. It went up and it exploded. I remember seeing that on television, not live, because I lived in the UK and it was not something they showed live, but all of the stories about that, and that there's a school teacher who was that was another thing. It was a school
when
teacher.
When was that?
1986. So in 1986, I was 6 years old. I remember seeing that on television very clearly. I was at my grandparents' place. They had a television and that was all the stuff that was happening. 1989, two other things happened, or a few more things happened. 1989, Tiananmen Square, and then the fall of the Berlin Wall, both together. 1990, end of apartheid. Those are the things that when I was a kid, I was aware of, that made me aware of world events. Of course, before the Berlin Wall fell, there was the Cold War and all of the nuclear annihilation and the four-minute warring. That's what I grew up with when I was a kid. It informed the way that I thought about stuff, you know, and watching movies. That was always the thing. The bad guys, not always the Russians, but the main threat was always nuclear stuff. All of the stories, it was always about nuclear, everything nuclear, bombs, everything nuclear, 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 that kind of stuff. And space travel was wrapped up for me. Of course, I was born... what, like 1960, like only a few years, like 20 years after people landed on the moon. But then the space shuttle, when I was a kid, it was all, everything was a space shuttle, fucking space shuttle, everything. And when the Challenger blew up, it's like, oh, space shuttle, what's going on there? And then apartheid and that kind of stuff going on too. So, but for you, of course, Juliana, 5 years younger than me, what's your first big event?
It's, I'm actually afraid to say this because this sounds so bad.
Yeah.
But the first thing I remember, I really remember thinking about, was when my mum came into, me and my dad, we were playing computer game, and my mum comes in and says, Lady Diana is dead. And for some reason I thought, ah, she stumbled and fell down a mountain or something. And this is the first thing I remember of, like,
world news. World actually stuff. It's weird to say this, because this is the next event which defines a new generation for me, is if you don't remember the fall of the Berlin Wall or
I was there but it didn't affect me, because
I know you lived in Berlin.
I mean, my parents, of course it affected it, of course, hugely.
But for you, when that happened, you were I was 9 years old.
I was five
and you were five, and that's the big difference. But Lady Diana Day is the next one, and after that it's 9/11, and I'm not quite sure what the next one after that is.
But 9/11, I don't even know where, probably in school.
But that's what I'm saying, it's the things that you remember about when you were a kid, like when you start noticing that there's other stuff going on in the world
than just your life.
Than just your life, which is generally around about 8, 9, 10 years old or something like that, you know? That's the kind of, maybe 12, you know, if you're a bit, if you're not quite as connected, that's the kind of thing. And then there'll be something that happened when you're an adult, and the Lady Diana dying, I was still at college and I was going to be doing some street show stuff, like some stilt walking or whatever I was going to do.
Stilt walking.
Me and Nathan were going to be doing a juggling show or something like that, and then it was cancelled because Lady Diana died. I thought it had been cancelled because it was raining that day, and I thought, I don't mind performing in the rain. So it was cancelled. So, oh, it's only raining. And I didn't realize how big Lady Diana dying was going to be.
But in the UK, of course.
But I just went downstairs that morning, and my father was like, oh, have you heard Lady Diana's died? And I was like, what? And he's like, yeah. And there's a car crash.
When you said Lady Diana died, what was your first thinking?
I didn't really have a thought. I was like, it was one of those things. And she was like, oh, yeah, she was in a car crash. And I was like, oh, okay. I mean, what else do you think? You know, I mean, I was like 16, 17 years old at the time. The 9/11. But what's the big news event? Like the big, not, I mean, Lady Diana Day wasn't world shaking, but it was world news.
No, but obviously
news.
It was like a very
But then,
impressive.
But like, but because that happened when Michael Jackson died, that isn't world news. We had our generation's, our generation was Lady Diana Dye, or I say my generation, I don't know. Anyway, so what I want to do is actually, when I'm talking about the science fiction world, when I was 8 years old, what was, and I'm going to say up until 10 years old, but what was I aware of back then? And what I'd be amazed, I think if I was 8 years old, the Berlin Wall hadn't come down. What I'd be amazed at is how little we talk about nuclear weapons now. Because like I say, when I was 8 years old, that was it. Like everything was wrapped up in there. All science fiction movies, it was all about... I'd say war games. I don't actually know when war games came out, but like even through to the 90s.
Somewhere in the middle of the 80s.
Yeah, and even through to the 90s and stuff like that, even like the James Bond that came out, GoldenEye, it was still Russians doing stuff, you know? It was that kind of, it was still a Cold War movie. It was like about the fall of the communism and other threats that came on. But you could kind of see the GoldenEye could very much have easily been a nuclear bomb shooting thing rather than, I can't even remember what it was, like electronic pulse kind of thing. They shot off. Anyway, I don't want to get into that much, but that was the kind of thing, and that's, I think, would be one of the things that I'd be most surprised about, is that
the Cold War is over, wasn't destroyed by nuclear bombs.
The nuclear disarmament has worked out. That isn't a constant threat, and now our threat isn't we're going to wipe out the whole world with a bomb. It's now a city might be destroyed by a dirty bomb or by a single bomb from somewhere.
Yeah.
That's so much nicer. I mean, of course, we're now worried about terrorism. Yeah. And I think that's one of the things. Of course, I wouldn't have had these thoughts fully developed in my mind as an 8-year-old. But I think I'd be like, what's so bad about terrorism? Like, you know, of course, 9/11, some buildings fell down. But like in 1989, or like before 1989, we'd be thinking those buildings came down. That could have triggered. I mean, at that time, that could have triggered the end of the world. I mean, that could have triggered World War III.
True. Yes.
And it kind of, and then, you know, America goes over and starts bombing Afghanistan and all that kind of stuff. And there's more Gulf War going on and all that kind of stuff. But there's never.
But that, I think the difference is that that doesn't affect us right now. That doesn't affect us in our lives right now.
No. We live in Berlin. Put it this way. If, like, I know it's weird to say this, but if the world politics and Cold War politics were still going on and Russia was invading,
we would be right in the corner.
Yeah, like if Russia was invading parts of the Ukraine, but I mean, of course, that was then the Soviet Union, but if Russia was invading parts of neighboring countries in 1989, we would all be shitting ourselves because it was going to be World War III was going to be here. Yeah. Now, we can kind of just ignore Putin. Of course, I don't think we should have just ignored Putin, and I think it's awful that they get like the Winter Olympics, and this weekend, or is it next weekend, the Formula One is going back to Sochi and stuff like that. I think it's like all of that kind of thing is just awful. And then in the 2022 Winter Olympics, they're going, where should it be? And Oslo's like, no, it's going to cost too much. And now it's just down to Beijing and Kazakhstan, two one-party systems, no democracy. And the IOC is going, oh shit, like no democracies want to be part of this anymore. And all these like Eastern Bloc, or you know, formerly communist or currently communist or whatever, you know, one party systems are like, yeah, we'll pay for it, we'll use the IOC and the Olympics to grandstand around. But like I say, we can kind of, I know it's weird to say this, but like we do just kind of let it go because we don't need to worry about nuclear war anyway. That's not so much a science fictional thing, but it is like a world thing that I think would do. Talking about space flight, I would be, as an 8-year-old kid who saw the Challenger disaster, and of course they did build another one. They built the Endeavour. No, there was a replacement one. No, Discovery, I think it was.
Discovery, yeah.
Was the Discovery, was the I replacement think. For Challenger? I would be horrified that there is no shuttle replacement in time for the shuttle not being there. Of course, I wouldn't be surprised that the shuttle went, did its 30 years of service, and it doesn't have any, or 20 years or so, 25 years, or however long it was actually running, and it didn't have any lifespan left. But I'd think, hey, they'd have something else going on there, wouldn't there? Like, they'd have another backup, wouldn't they? No, we're just relying on the Russians to get us. And it kind of ties into that. It's like, wait, we're relying on the Russians? Like, I say we, but, like, the Western world doesn't have human launch capabilities. So that would be something that would go on as well. I was going to talk about apartheid and racism and that stuff, but we talked about that, and it's just depressing.
It's just depressing.
It's just depressing.
Let's go to something cool.
I don't want to. What's that timeline of world history?
I tried to find the next
major events history timeline.
I tried to find the correct key into Google.
I don't think after 9/11. I don't think there's been a big I mean, it's gonna be like somebody walking on Mars or something, like landing a human on Mars, like, you know, like the world, like the moon landings. Where were you when the moon landings? Where were you when Kennedy was shot? Where were you when the Berlin Wall fell?
Well, look at this. There's on Wikipedia. There's a timeline of the future.
Disambiguation. Let's not get sucked into that. And I just want to bring in this as well. I grew up, and I said before, I grew up in a Christian family, which I don't want to go into more now, but also I grew up in a house with no television. And I kind of wanted to kind of bring in Minding Tomorrow, my novel, a bit about what it's like to come to the future. And because in that book, someone goes away and lives in Thailand on an island in Thailand for like 15 years or something, and then comes back to the Western world. Because he was so paranoid, he kind of shunned all technology and then is like, okay, let's get back into this now.
Yeah.
And he comes back into it and he's just bombarded by adverts on all sides, and he puts on the glasses, and he's just having adverts beamed into his eyes.
And he pays money to get rid of
and
adverts.
And he pays money to get rid of the adverts, but then there's no adverts on the walls of anywhere. He's walking around, and the imagery that I use from that is actually Eastern European countries before the fall of the Berlin Wall, where there was no adverts, there was just buildings, and everyone knew where the buildings were. They didn't even have to have signs on them. And of course, in the future, it's like a mix-up between Eastern Bloc countries with no signposts and no advertising, and the internet with adverts being bombarded directly into your eyes and the kind of things that happen there.
Just the life in the former GDR and the life in the Western Berlin.
Yeah, and that's what I wanted to say about that kind of fast forwarding into the future. But growing up in a house with no television, I wasn't exposed to adverts. I wasn't even exposed to that many moving pictures. Like, I read a lot and we did a lot of active stuff.
And I think...
You've got to talk into the microphone.
Yes, but I think it's actually a fun fact that you grew up without television, and I grew up 5 years after the wall came down, and we always had a television.
Yeah.
I have a conscious mind.
Yeah.
We always had a telephone, and shortly after the wall came down, and I was about 6 or 7, we had a computer.
Yep.
Which... compared to a lot of other people in the former East, was a huge step up.
Anyway, what I wanted to say about that was that in my book, Man Who Tomorrow, I wanted to kind of capture what it's like for me to be anywhere where there's a TV. I just can't not look at the TV. Like if I'm in it, not so much now, but it used to be that if I was in a bar or anywhere public and there was a TV, I couldn't not look at it. And even if my back was to it, it was really difficult. And it's overwhelming to go into the future that way, like to grow up in a culture where television is taken for granted and just not be part of it. And then,
side note, Luke still does that when there's a television in a
but
restaurant.
Doesn't everybody do it?
No.
Can people I don't know how people can ignore television or anything like that. I hate graffiti. I hate adverts. I hate public screens or showing anything which isn't information and stuff like that. But I would hate to live, and this is the thing that I try and bring about in that novel, in Minding Tomorrow. I'd hate to live in a world where there was no public art, or only government created or only sanctioned public art, because it's so boring. So it's one of those kind of things where I'm like, I hate graffiti, I hate advertising, but I wouldn't want to live in a place where we had to rely on existing architecture for our visual landscape.
Yeah.
And trees and architecture. I just don't think trees and architecture is enough. I kind of need other decorations. And weirdly enough, shop fronts kind of do that in a way. Adverts kind of do that. They give a culture to a location beyond architecture.
And to a time. And to a time. And what people are doing right now.
Yeah, I was talking to... who was I talking to? I can't remember. It was Stephanie. I was talking about Four Weddings and a Funeral, and I was saying that's an amazing movie because it doesn't for the most part it hasn't aged, because everyone in that movie it's four weddings and a funeral, so it's five very formal occasions, and everyone is wearing formal clothes.
Very 80s formal clothes, though.
No, well, it was 92, I think, 93 that it came out. But the point is that it's very formal, and formal kind of is kind of timeless. It ages very well, except for the time when he goes out shopping to fit someone's wedding dress.
Yes.
And he goes out and fits the wedding dress, and he's wearing this just awful shorts, an awful nasty shirt, and that's when it's like, oh, 90s, oh, really, oh, that's two 90s, and then they go back to the weddings and funerals, and you're like, oh, now this makes sense, you know, and you suddenly...
Suits again.
Yeah, everyone's wearing suits and kilts and smart clothes are way less timeless, and I know that's weird to say. Anyway, what else was I going to say? There was this one final thing we've gone on. I was hoping to wrap this up in maybe about an hour and 10 minutes, but an hour and a half is fine.
I still want to come up with my quote. You remember that, yeah?
Yes, we're going to get to that right now. Instead of talking about science fiction, how about talking about fiction that is made science? Is this what we're going? Like, we come into the future. What, what hasn't become science? Do your quote.
As I said before, this is a quote from Mr. Penumbra's 24-hour bookstore. And there...
Author?
I don't know. Is it here? Robin Sloan. I'm not very well prepared. Anyway.
Okay, do the quote.
So they talk about singularity.
Okay.
And this is kind of what we're talking about
In the science fiction, you know, in a science fiction book, they're talking about singularities.
I don't know if it's a science fiction book. It's a book. And here they say, okay, we're going to play. To start, imagine the future, the good future, no nuclear bombs. Pretend you're a science fiction writer. Okay. The me character says, world government, no cancer, hoverboard.
Nice quote.
Spaceships, party on Mars.
Further, what else did it say?
Further, Star Trek, transporters, you can go anywhere.
Yeah.
Further. I pause a moment, then I realize I can't.
You can't. You can't think further towards the singularity. Once you can go anywhere and there's transporters and replicators.
This is the quote. And I just wanted to point out that world government, no cancer, hoverboards is what I really would love to have now.
You want to live in the culture.
They don't have hoverboards.
They can have hoverboards.
That was always what I thought we would have by now. I thought we would have hoverboards by now.
Yeah, because you grew up watching Back to the Future.
Yes.
Two.
I love it.
So I just wanted to bring in this as well. What I thought we'd have that we don't have. Oh, no. So like this. Talking fiction that is made into science fiction. I mentioned this in different reviews of Snow Crash, where they have the metaverse and cyberspace and stuff like that, and living in these computer created worlds. And what always annoys me is that you live in them, but there's no reason to live in them, because if you want to communicate, we're in the real world. You can just send text messages. If you want to do anything, if you want to interact, you don't need to have a fake world. So there has to be another reason for the fake world to exist.
A dystopia?
What, that you're trying to escape from the dystopia and go and live in a good one?
You try to escape the real world by going into a fake world.
Okay, that could be it, but why would you go in there with other people if you could create it yourself? Like in Blindsight, they create the world for themselves and they're the god of their own world.
Yeah, but that's boring and socially not
exactly
good.
But why do we need to recreate a world inside a computer and then interact inside that world when we can just use iMessages and email and Facebook and Twitter and all of these other social networks that we already have, which don't require logging on, putting on goggles and going inside a 3D world? The 3D world just gets in the way. And I think what's cool now is Minecraft, which is finally getting there. And the reason why you go into Minecraft, you have all those social interactions there and you can go around and you can look at avatars and you can go on trips together and go exploring. But the point is you're there to create stuff. And I think Minecraft is the first successful online social interaction thing which isn't a computer game, which is actually, I mean, it is a computer game, but Second Life, you had to pay your Linden dollars. You had to pay real money to be in there.
What about SimCity?
SimCity is just a computer game. You're not with other people in SimCity.
Oh, okay.
You're creating a fake world, but you're not interacting with other people.
But Second Life, you had to pay money. You didn't have to pay money.
Yeah, you paid Linden dollars. You bought Linden. Their business model was you bought Linden dollars, and you paid for stuff. If you wanted other stuff, you could create it yourself, or you could pay for it. You could pay other people for it.
Yeah, create it or pay for it. It's like in the real world.
Yeah, the point is that in Minecraft, you don't. The whole point, the reason why it exists, is for creation. The reason why Minecraft is getting bigger, and they say that all of the stuff that's ever in Minecraft, all of the Minecraft servers, you put them all together, and it's like the size of Jupiter or something like that. You know,
what?
It's like it's like bigger than the real world.
What about World of Warcraft and stuff?
World of Warcraft, people are there to play a game. They're not creating anything. Everything that's made there is made by people. Employees of Blizzard make stuff, and then other people play it out.
Okay, and in Minecraft, there are no people who get paid to create something.
They create the tools for other people, the users, to create the world. And that's the big difference. And people don't pay to be in Minecraft worlds.
But I could never... I mean, I've never played this game, and I
You're
I
not
just...
8-year-old boy.
Yeah, but it's square.
But the point is...
It's like Lego.
It's reducing everything down to Lego bricks. And that's the genius of it, is that you don't have to be a computer designer. You don't have to be a graphic designer. You don't have to be a 3D artist to be able to design stuff that looks good, that you can sell other people and make houses in Second Life. That's not what it's for. It's for creation. And I think that's one of the first times that we're actually getting a true metaverse. People have a reason to be there, which isn't social interaction and which isn't showing off stuff that they've paid for.
You mean it's building world?
They're actually building the world.
Okay.
And I think that's one of the first things that we're seeing now, one of those first, you know, I know that's a weird thing, but the currency of Minecraft is how much work you've put into it. It's not how much money you've had to buy other stuff. It's how, like, you're really cool, you're really good at Minecraft, and you're a big name in Minecraft if you've created something.
Okay.
Not if you've paid for something.
And you say this is fiction that becomes science?
I think this is the first true this is the first worthwhile 3D social system, which is, like, could be said to be inspired by the metaverse in Snow Crash, which is actually successful. Because it's not relying on people buying status. with real money. And it has a reason to exist, which isn't just showing off stuff that you've bought and social interactions.
You should really read Ready Player One.
Oh, should I?
Yes.
Okay. I will read that at some point.
Okay.
I have it. I have it on my shelf.
I just have this timeline of the near future open on Wikipedia.
I just wanted to talk about Elon Musk and SpaceX because I just wanted to tie
back. This is really cool stuff that's written
here. Okay, let me just go back in there a second. Okay. Elon Musk and SpaceX, one of those things that you always read in science fiction is about the lone guy. This is coming back to Ayn Rand and objectivism is like, I want to do this. Of course, he's doing it because Elon Musk is... He made his money in the internet, and that's something that a lot of science fiction didn't see coming, is the internet and all that kind of stuff. Okay. He made his money in the internet and is like, now I'm going to change the world. Electric cars and take people to Mars. There is nobody more science fictional. He is literally a character from Heinlein. He is literally a character Baxter characters where it's like, okay, we've got 80 days to reach the moon. How are we going to do it? And it's like, well, we're going to get this one guy who's going to have a vision. He's going to get this technology.
And this guy who has enough money.
Yeah, and Elon Musk has his own superpower, which is he's very clever at business. It turns out the superpower that you have to have is technical know-how and vision and also... be very good at business.
Yes.
And it turns out the guy who, he didn't create PayPal, but he managed to get a lot of money from that. And then he put all of his money and other people's, he owns a majority share in Tesla and in SpaceX and is getting billions of dollars from NASA to do NASA's job for him. It's like, there is nobody more science fiction than Elon Musk. And I don't know anything about him politically. I don't know anything about personally, but he appeals to me as one of these, like, people who read, I don't want to say Ayn Rand stuff, but you know, like these, he's the perfect libertarian, self-made man, but he doesn't have the objectivist self-interest stuff. He's literally doing this stuff because he's like, I don't want humanity to be stuck on Earth. I want humanity to explore, to be on Mars. It's like that podcast that we listened to with the owner of the rights to Tetris, who is like, I have
enough money and now I want to spend it to make the world better.
He's like, let's stop war. Let's terraform Mars. And what he says, and then I want to solve the heat death of the universe. He said we've got to work out how the universe ends and stop it happening. And and I only have that on my plans and goals because that puts the rest of my problems into perspective. And you're like, oh, that's really clever. But the whole idea, and that's the thing with Elon Musk. Electric cars, because fuck it, nobody else is doing it. He's making a lot of money. But this is one of those things that I don't believe he is motivated by money. He really is motivated.
There will be a Tesla shop opening in
Berlin. We're going to go on a test drive and stuff like that. So we are, both of us, we do watch the SpaceX launches and are interested in that and the Dragon unveiling and all this cool stuff. Because we're science fiction fans and Elon Musk
He puts the fiction into the science.
He is our science fiction hero. He is the archetypal science fiction hero of our. Again, I don't want to denigrate anybody else who's involved in that company, but he is the one who is actually doing it cleverly and cheaply. And that's it. Turns out cheap space flight is how you get to Mars. It's not doing the NASA way of doing everything safely and doing everything like that. He's like, oh yeah, we've got this space. No, what was it called? The Grasshopper and the vertical launch thing. That'll probably blow up at some point. And guess what? It blew up. And it's just like, yeah, that's what we're expecting. And we're going to do this. Okay. I think that's everything I wanted to go through. There was a few other things like, 250 a show devoted to figuring out the best science fiction authors. This can be done in several ways. I'm not going to do that. Because it's too subjective. I have my favorites, and I can't think there's a best of anything.
Yeah.
You know? And also, Dylan Harris, I propose that for episode 250, Juliana reviews Minding Tomorrow, and Luke isn't allowed to interrupt. Go for it. We will do that in an upcoming episode. We'll do an episode of Minding Tomorrow. So your future timeline, and then we'll wrap it up. I think that's everything I want to talk about.
So in the 2020s, it says, the Voyager program is expected to terminate. And then 2022, European Space Agency plans to launch JUICE for exploration of Jupiter's icy moon by 2022.
I forgot to pick up my microphone again. Where's that from?
It's on Wikipedia, timeline of the near future.
But where is it calculated from?
I don't know. It's just obviously just you can click on everything.
Oh no, this is actually things that are planned.
This is actually things that are planned. This is nothing I'm coming up with.
I thought you were talking about as mentioned in science fiction.
It's not fiction. It is science. In the book, why I wanted to bring this up.
I thought it was in the book 2061.
No. This is actually future
things that are going to happen.
2029. The message from Earth will reach Gliese 581, whichever that is, planet. Star. 2030, European Space Agency spacecraft JUICE is expected to enter the Jovian system.
Wow, this is long range. This is why that was it. The Society of the Long Now, or the sort of like the Long Now Society, where someone is making a clock, which is it's a thing where a clock, they're setting a clock, and the alarm is going to go off in like, you know, 120,000 years time or a million years time or something like that. And it's like, no, we're building this clock now because we've got to think long term. We can't just think 4 years time. We can't just think 10 years time.
And
we can't even think 50 years time.
Cool.
Anyway, I will have a look at that list myself later.
It's a very cool list. Anyway, in the 2000, 2000.
What's the last thing on the list? Go right down to the bottom of the list. Say the last thing on our future history list.
Yeah, there's another list for the 2300s.
Okay.
This ends with 2290s. For farther future dates, see third millennium list of millennia.
Yeah, but all of the all the far ones.
And the one before is 2281, 2282, Grand Trine of Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto. This last occurred in 17. Well, that's just something that.
Oh, so that's where they all come together or something? Yeah, but all of the real future ones are astronomical events. Aren't they? It's a return of Halley's Comet.
This
and all
is
that
all
stuff.
The stuff that you can actually mathematically
predict. Turns out psychohistory doesn't exist, and Harry Seldon can't come out and say calculate civilizations into the future. Anyway, I think that was a very fun podcast. A little bit longer than I was expecting. It turns out we can talk a lot about movies. And about everything.
And then people shouldn't ask too many questions about it because then they get this long podcast.
Yeah. Some of the longest ones we talked about were only a line long. Anyway, that's it. We said what's coming up in the future at the beginning. So email me, luke@juggler.net. If you enjoyed this, you can actually just carry on this thread on SFPRP Goodreads listener
group.
Probably
will be a 300 episode.
Yes, we will get to... Oh, that was another thing we were talking about. I calculated when I would get to episode 1,000 and have to increase a leading zero because I started off episode 001. I had leading zeros and
now they're gone.
They're gone now, so in we're a quarter of the way to messing up the leading zeros, and it's taken me how long to get here? So January 2008 9 10 11 12 13 14 and a half. So yeah, that's like 14 and a half. We're more than halfway through. That's 7.5 years to get to 250. So in another 23 and a half years, I'll get to episode 1,000.
That sounds scary.
It does when I think about it that way. But who knows? Maybe the science fiction book review podcast is one of the things I've done longest in my life. If you understand,
yes,
it's now longer than my longest relationship. Actually, I think I've lived in this house. Well, I started it in this house where I'm living now because I've lived here for over coming up for 8 years or something. So lived in Berlin 9 years. So no, I think I actually started it when I was living in my previous house. I don't even know. So it's one of those weird things. So thanks a lot for listening to all 250 episodes, plus the bonus episodes, plus the SFF audio podcast that I've been on, which I've stuck in the feed as well. There's quite a lot of those too. And other podcasts. I hope you're enjoying the addition of Juliana to the podcast as well. I think people do. So anyway, email me, luke@juggler.net. Follow me on Twitter, @LukeBurridge. Become my friend on goodreads.com. And now we'll say goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.